Servus und herzlich willkommen in einem neuen Video der Mission Money. Ja, heute wollen wir mal schauen, wie ein erfolgreicher Milliardär eigentlich sein Geld so investiert und das seiner Kunden und wie er den Markt im kommenden Jahr einschätzt. Dazu haben wir einen spannenden Gast aus den USA. Er ist Milliardär, seit vielen Jahrzehnten erfolgreicher Investor, ist auf der Forbes-Liste auch ein bekannter Kolumnist. Er war schon mal vor 2019 war es zu Gast bei der Mission Money und ich kann jetzt sagen, welcome back, Ken Fisher.
Thanks for having me.
It's an honor and pleasure to having you on the show. Let's have a look back to this year. Most economists were predicting a recession for the US economy over the year. And what we saw was a little bit different. Economic growth getting stronger and stronger over the year. So why were they all so wrong?
Well, Peter, I guess you could view that two ways. One is economists have never been very good at forecasting anything anyway. So why should this year have been different? When I was young in university, I studied economics and came to the view then that it wasn't very good at forecasting. The reality, however, is that often people confuse things. And one of the things that was confused a lot in this year was that rolling into the year, you had a hangover from pessimism from 2022. A lot of the superficial indicators, like the yield curve inversion or the leading economic indexes, all pointed to recession. And then there's all the other things to get worried about, like the continuing Russian-Ukraine war and oil and geopolitical and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And the impact of all of that is that they miss the bigger picture, which is that 2023 was an evolution of a relative return to normalcy from what had been an ongoing, very abnormal period. COVID, the lockdowns associated with COVID, the fast bounce backs, the overexpansion of the quantity of money globally by central banks, then the Ukraine war, the rise of inflation, all of those things in 2022 were all very abnormal. And what felt to a lot of people like they were being attacked by a hive of bees. And what they missed is after all that, you remember the supply chain shortages, all of these things. But in 2023, those things are all smoothing out and returning to a more normal world, more normal growth rates, not perfectly so, but more so. Improving inflation back closer to normal, not normal, but more so. Supply chain problems completely reversed. Globally, supply chain indexes are at record clarity. And you just go through, and it's missing the relative return to normalcy, which is ongoing right now and probably continues well into 2024.
Mm-hmm. And now this year, the forecast for 2024 are, you can say, all over the place. So they are very uncertain of what can happen next year. That makes it very interesting. What would you say is your scenario for the U.S. economy in the next year?
So let me just ladder on top of what I had said before. The relative return to normalcy should continue. That will continue to get people surprised as they keep looking for problems around every corner and skepticism remains relatively high. When you look at, and I've done this for decades, when you look at professional forecasters' forecasts for the stock market, what they can agree on a year out doesn't happen because that's what's already been pre-priced in the marketplace. I've done this over and over and over, and therefore what they can agree on becomes what isn't likely. When you look at currently professional forecasters' forecasts for the market, what I used to always like to say was that professional forecasters as a group are wronger, longer, and stronger. But the reality of current forecasts is for a median return of 2.9%. And only 15% of professional forecasters' forecasts are above the long-term average of history. 24% are negative returns. And therefore, what's least likely is returns that cluster around low single digits, slightly negative or a little higher. And what's more likely is something that's either much worse, tied to some big shock, or much better, which is what I think will happen. I think the economy is going to continue to move along okay. The stock market should have a good year for a whole series of reasons. And one of the big things that people miss is that these things like the yield curve don't work right now the way they've traditionally worked because of things that happened during COVID. Consumers became flush with cash. Banks became flush with deposits. And the reason the yield curve always worked before is it was a leading indicator of future bank lending. When the yield curve would get inverted, the cost of borrowing was too high relative to the long-term lending rate banks could lend at, and they pulled back their lending. This time that didn't happen because the bank's cost of deposits globally was so low that they continued to have positive gross margins, net interest margins from lending.
So you think that there's no bigger impact if the inverted yield curve gets close?
Do I think that has an impact? Yes, I do think it has an impact, but I think it's a much smaller impact than it's traditionally had and that most people think it will have. The reality is what really matters, what the yield curve always was an approximator of bank future costs of deposits versus their future rate they could lend at. And when that got knocked out of whack, then that caused banks to react. But during the COVID period, short-term interest rates became totally disassociated with the bank's cost of deposits. So therefore, it didn't have anything to do with their ongoing lending activities and how that would impact commerce. In history, when the yield curve inverted, banks stopped lending when you were a business, like so many in Germany, that have to keep financing inventory and have to keep financing various projects, and the bank stops lending to you, you have to pull back. That causes recession.
Mm. Yeah, but we see lending is degrowing now. Right?
It's growing. It's still growing globally, but at a slower rate than it was. It's still growing more than enough to keep the economy moving forward.
Okay, so that's enough for the economy, you think? So these financial conditions, we always looked over the last couple of months on all these charts going up with the lending conditions getting better, not better. You think there is enough money going around the companies for the economy?
Yes, but let's distinguish services versus manufacturing. The reality is all of this is harder on manufacturers than it is on service firms. The other part that humans have built into their brains wrongly is to think of physical goods and manufacturing as more important than services, when services are so much bigger than manufacturing in today's world. The fact is, what people need to keep an eye on more is what goes on with services, not what goes on with manufacturing. It's services today that drive the economy, whereas we all come from a place where once upon a time it was manufacturing, and those physical items that we see and feel have a bigger emotional tug on what we expect moving forward, which is wrong.
And we see the PMIs for what you said, as they are always above 50, yeah?
For the services side.
For the service part, not for the manufacturing, right.
Services are doing just fine, manufacturing suffering some. The reality is during COVID, we bought a lot of stuff. During COVID, when people were shut into their houses and governments kept shoving money at people, you could buy things online and have them shipped to your house. And the reality is people bought a lot of stuff then. And once you get your house filled up with stuff, how much more stuff do you need?
Mm-hmm. Let's move on and look on the markets. If you see the survey of the Bank of America, fund manager survey, you know it. Now 2/3 think we have no landing or soft landing. Are you also in this corner? I got you.
Let me revert to what I was saying when we first started talking. We're in a process of returning to relative normalcy. That in 2023 has had the economy growing when people didn't expect it would. And I believe that we will continue to move toward growing at a relatively more normal rate than 2023 was, which is neither no landing or soft landing. It's continued minor acceleration of growth.
The market is pricing 3 to 4 rate cuts next year for the U.S. Do you think, is that a realistic scenario?
Let me say I don't really know.
Yeah.
We all don't know. Let me say that this way. Central bankers are just crazy. That's it. Once you get that, you say, only a fool makes forecasts predicated on crazy people. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever, ever heard Warren Buffett make a forecast about anything predicated on what central banks did?
I don't think so.
Never.
Never.
That's pretty good guidance and wisdom as to how to think about central banks. Do central banks matter? Yes. Do they matter nearly as much as most people think they do? No. For the most part, the more people ignore central banks, the better off they are. Now, let me add a point to that. In the marketplace, markets are pre-pricers of all widely known information. That's always been true. Markets are pretty good, not perfect, at pricing the future. When everybody's worried about something, one of the things that I've always told people is you don't have to worry about it. They're already doing it for you as a free service. Ignore what they're worrying about. You don't have to. They've done it as this service. Just focus on other things that are therefore in the marketplace more important. And you can ignore that. With everyone so fixated over recent years on Fed, Eurobank, on and on and on, worrying about that is pointless.
Yeah. But on the other hand is, and that's the question behind it, is if we have 3 or 4 rate cuts, maybe not, we don't know, because they are crazy, there must be a massive economic slump.
No, because that presumes that the central bankers are rational enough to see that correctly. They're crazy. If they're crazy, you don't know what they'll do. And whatever they do, you shouldn't put as much importance into it as most people seem to. Let me go a different direction. Let me make a couple of more points on this. Most of the central bank rate increases happened at starting in the middle of 2022. You know that. From October 2022, we only had gotten about 1/3 of them. And the stock market's been up steadily. And in Germany, in the DAX, not on an inflation-adjusted basis, but on an absolute euro basis, the DAX is at all-time highs. The fact of the matter is people believe things like rising interest rates make stocks go down. all you got to be able to do is look at the very, very long history of stock prices and the very, very long history of interest rates to know that there is no correlation there. When I say that, correlation doesn't prove causality, but a lack of correlation proves a lack of causality. And actually, long-term rates rising or falling has a slightly positive correlation with stock prices. That is, when long-term interest rates have gone up, there's a slight correlation, not strong enough to believe in, for stocks to go up also. And when long-term rates have fallen, a slight tendency, not enough to believe in, for stocks to fall. That's exactly the reverse of what most people think. I find it amazing that people continue to think the things they think when two things that you can measure precisely as to how they wiggle together or don't confirm what they believe.
And that's the last question on it, because that's interesting. What do you think about all these higher for longer discussions?
Same thing. No different. You know, if you were to think about risks, the real risk might be if suddenly central bankers weren't crazy, because that could really scare the dickens out of everybody, because they're so used to central bankers being, in their mind, so important. If in America, for example, Jay Powell, or in the Eurobank, Christine Lagarde, were to say, hey, you know, we really don't matter much. You all think we're much more important than we are. We really don't accomplish much. It would drive people who believe otherwise crazy. And that might, that could be a real interesting problem.
Definitely, but too many people listen to what they have to say.
That's absolutely right.
What would you say, what are the biggest risks for the stock market next year before we come to the other side of the chance?
So I think there's a whole series of political risks, geopolitical risks, that I don't think people place importance on, but should. Let me revert. They're not the ones that everybody talks about, because the ones that everybody talks about are the ones that are priced. I think the biggest single risk is a potential problem in the Indian Triangle, which is, if you go back to the beginning of the Ukraine war, oil's flowing where it's flowing. The West puts sanctions on Russian oil. And so Russia increases its sales of oil and energy product to China and India. Then you fast forward into the back part of last year, and they start selling to Pakistan, which raises the relative price to India. Now, India and Pakistan have never gotten along very well. They've been irregular, but off and on, border conflicts between the two. China and India don't always get along all that well. They're adjacent in a triangle. And there are three nuclear powers. That, as a potential powder keg, is actually a much more realistic risk, because America and the West only really have the ability to engage currently in two military theaters at once, not the ability to engage in three or four. And as soon as you would have a third that we would have to try to play some side in, which presumably would be aligned with India, you now get to the point where it becomes obvious to everyone that we couldn't handle any more. And that would be a big scare to the market. Other scares in the geopolitical realm are just simply what you might refer to as agedness. You take people of the age of President Biden or former President Trump, they're both of an age where, in the middle of the stress of a campaign, one of them could drop dead. both of them could drop dead. Heaven forbid. In that process, what happens after that? Nobody knows, except for people would become very concerned and uncertainty would go through the roof. You could extend that other ways. Let me make some of them scarier. Vladimir Putin is of an age. His health isn't good. People talked a year or two ago about potentially him having health issues. But what if he went because nobody knows what would be behind him? That would scare people. And then the third one is, I mean, I'm a septuagenarian. You know, I was 73 just a little while ago. And I'm in pretty good shape for a man my age, but I know what happens to people my age, and some of them just drop dead out of nowhere. And so is President Xi in China. You follow? And if he went, nobody knows what's behind him, because during his reign of power, he's gutted most all the competent younger people underneath him. And in that, nobody knows what would fill the vacuum if he was gone. And that would be uncertainty. So I think all of these things are ones that nobody focuses on and should. Whereas the ones that they do focus on, they're focusing on because everybody else focuses on them and you don't have to.
We talked about the presidential election in the US next year. What do you think, what impacts can this have for the stock markets?
So let me just make some bullet points. Presidential election years in the United States since the beginning of the S&P 500 have been positive 83% of history, with an 11% average return. In a year where the president's second year of his term was negative, like 2022 was, the election year was positive 100% of the time, all the way back to 1932, at the very bottom of the Great Depression, with average returns of 15%. When we have a Democrat running as president for re-election, the returns during the presidential year have been relatively irregularly staggered throughout the year. When we've had a Republican president running for re-election, the returns have tended to be back-end loaded in the back half of the year. But this time, because it would be President Biden running for re-election as a Democrat, you probably have a pretty good year, and it's probably pretty steady. And that's also perfectly parallel to what I've referred to earlier tonight in this as a relative return to normalcy. Let me just make one more point. And I've written about this lots of times, lots of places, including Focus Money. The fact is, in my opinion, this period is closest in history by far. In so many ways, there are differences, but more parallel by far to the markets of 1966 being like 2022, 1967 being like 2023, and 1968 being like 2024. And therefore, the political impact should be positive. The reality at a different level is simultaneously, you have in America Senate elections and House of Representative elections. But in both those chambers, the makeup of the elections is such that neither party can have a huge swing. They can only have a little swing in favor or against them. So the Republicans may pick up some seats in the House, or they may lose the House because they've only got a three-seat majority as we speak today. But in the Senate, they may pick up enough to take the Senate. They may not. They won't lose seats in the Senate, but they may not gain the Senate. So you still end up with a government with a very divided state legislature, relative gridlock, no matter who wins the presidency. And overall, it's a net positive because government doing things scares the market. Government not doing things makes the market more calm. And that's what happens. If you just look at the history of the U.S. stock market, arrayed by the first year of a president's term, second year, third year, and fourth year, not all, but almost all the negative years are in the first 2 years, which constitute about half of all of those first 2 years. The third year is almost perfectly positive, and the fourth year, a little bit worse, but again, 83% positive. In America, all big legislation happens in the first 2 years of president's terms. All controversial legislation happens in the first 2 years of president's terms. In the third and fourth years, governmental activity quiets down. And as it quiets down, markets feel calmer.
But we have a lot of elections next year over the planet. European Parliament, Taiwan in January is something we have to look about it, huh?
I agree with that. Let me just say that, forgetting about Taiwan for a moment, when you look around Europe, what we're seeing in the Netherlands, what we're about to see in Belgium, is what I think we will see more broadly, which is electing governments that can't be strong. If you look at the Dutch election, which people got very excited about in terms of who came out ahead, you still have the classic Dutch problem of taking a long time to form a government and having that government be inherently fragile. When you look around Europe, that's going to continue to be the problem.
And we have, of course, a lot of time where nothing happens in the European Parliament. That is, it's a big thing, yeah? It's different to the elections in the US. There's a lot of headlines, but work is always normal working.
A lot of yak, 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 and a lot of this, but not a lot of this.
No, normal life is going on.
Yep, exactly. But
that's what we are not having in the European Parliament. But it's not that important because we have national states. They are also working normally. But we have not these European. But let's now we have talked about all the risks. And now we want to hear, of course, something about what can there be on the upside.
So I revert back to what I was saying about the U.S. market relative to politics. What I said earlier about this period of 2022, 23, and 24 being like 1966, 67, and 68, it ought to be a good year in the equity market. You do not need to see short or long-term interest rates come down a lot. The reality is when we look back at the longer-term history in more normal times before quantitative easing, which throughout the time period that I've written in Focus Money, I've referred to quantitative easing actually as quantitative diseasing, because it doesn't work the way people think it does. It's actually contractionary and deflationary. It's the reason why the period from 2010 to 2020 was such low inflation and such low growth. What it does is forces banks to build their reserves, which it did very effectively, but it does not stimulate, it does not create the quantity of money. The quantity of money between 2010 and 2020 grew at the slowest rate of any decade in U.S. history, because it doesn't create money at a time when everybody was thinking it did, but they never looked at the money itself. The facts in my mind point to a world where interest rates now are getting closer to what's normal, which is 4% long bonds. Short-term interest rates being a little above or below that, maybe falling some, but don't have to fall a lot. We had a great world of economic growth and market growth with these kinds of interest rates bouncing around a little, but these kind of interest rates for a really long time in a pre-2008-9 world. And we're just not used to getting back to that relative normalcy. So I don't see huge movements in bonds. I don't think we need huge movements in bonds. When you look, another point to make just simply is that corporate balance sheets are more cash flush and in better condition today by far, a factor of 2 to 1 over what they were 20 and 30 years ago, a point that almost everyone misses. Likewise, when you look at the American consumer and the Western European consumer, which constitute most of the biggest chunk of global GDP, they have put themselves in a stronger balance sheet position relative to these interest rates than was the case 20 and 30 years ago. All of which is something that people don't think through. They don't even look at. They assume the consumer's in problem. They can assume that credit card debt is too high, or this is too high, or that is too high, but they don't consider the total picture of total consumer debt versus what the consumer has and what the consumer's income is. And either one of those shows the consumer in the Western world in vastly better condition than they were 20 or 30 years ago when people think they're in worse condition. So all that says to me, as we move back in a relative return to normalcy, there's plenty of financing power to make that happen.
So the U.S. consumer is strong enough next year to hold the economy alive.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, fine. It's great to hear. If we looked at the companies and the forecasts for the earnings growth next year, this consensus is pretty solid, 10 to 12% plus next year. Do you think that is realistic? I mean, that's a strong growth.
I think these kinds of forecasts could change 5 times next year.
At a minimum.
And still not have very much meaning. The reality is, in the same way that when you asked the very first question of why were economists wrong in 2023, I said they weren't very good at forecasting. People have never been very good at making macro earnings forecasts. Macro earnings forecasts have been steadily way off. And then they vacillate quite a lot. And there's no actual correlation between those vacillations and what happens to the stock market. They vacillate faster in some ways than they should, if you were to believe that there's a correlation between them and subsequent stock prices. The fact is, by the time we know what those forecasts are, they're pretty much already in the stock prices.
We have seen this year this Magnificent Seven rising very, very high instead of the rest of the market. So you've written about that, your concept of the bounce effect. We have to say it was a complete success. For everyone who didn't read about that, can you explain the idea behind that a bit more in detail? And the other questions comes later.
Well, I certainly hope I can explain it in more detail. It would be bad if I couldn't. First, too often people think that in a bear market, it's these kind of stocks that should fall and not those kind, which is a forecast. But forecasts aren't always very perfect. In a lot of bear markets in the past, more than not, by about 2 to 1, in bear markets, what were perceived as high quality companies fell less because there's fear of recession, and low quality companies fell more, and particularly smaller low quality companies fell more because there was fear if the economy is really going to be that terrible, boy, oh boy, those smaller, lower quality companies, they just might go bankrupt. In 2022, the part of the market that fell the most was the bigger, growthier companies, including those things like the Magnificent Seven that you referenced, but also other ones that were in the growthy category, whether it was French or European luxury goods stocks or many other smaller techie growthy companies. The fact that I think most people miss is that categorically, it's the categories that fall the most in a bear market, that as categories, not every single stock, but as categories bounce the most early in a new bull market. That's the bounce effect. And all you had to do was say, A, we've had a big downturn. What's fallen the most as categories? And B, do you think the bear market's over? If you think the bear market's over, then you knew what you thought would bounce, which is the stuff that fell the most as categories. Then, of course, within that, you do some stock picking, but you're looking at the Magnificent Seven and other growth things, whether they're tech or not. And then, of course, what fell the least in 2022 was value, which is normally thought of as lower quality, which most people should have expected to fall more in a, if there was to be a recession, which didn't come, of course. And then in 2023, and coming off the bottom of the bear market in October of 2022, the value stocks didn't bounce the way the growth stocks did.
And there are not just one phase, there are two phases in this bounce effect, right?
So the first part is just like a spring unloading. Then the second part is a transition into what continues to be able to grow in a low growth environment. What we had in the beginning of 23 was people expecting recession, as you said earlier, coupled with an economy that was growing, but only a little in the beginning of 2023, and therefore not a lot of growth to help the companies that are very economically sensitive. But the companies that can grow when the economy's not stood out as rare, particularly the few Magnificent Seven. And therefore, money would concentrate in those because they could generate real growth when other companies weren't generating real growth in revenue and earnings per share. And that made them extra rare and therefore extra valuable. As the year rolls on and growth continues accelerating, which should continue into 2024, you move into a world that becomes much more balanced. Because as the growth rate of the economy continues improving, you get more benefit for the companies that can't grow inherently, that are more economically sensitive, typically the value ones. And that pulls them up and reduces the rarity of the exceptional growth companies. So what I would say is that as we move into 2024, you would expect to still see the growth ones doing well, bull market, but the value ones doing relatively better than they had been, and both sides of the market, growth and value, as well as big and small, moving much more harmoniously upward.
So next year, we have to look a bit about more about value stocks and the smaller stocks, right?
Next year, on a relative basis, should be a better year for those stocks than 2023 was. But it should be a year that's pretty good for all of the four blocks: big, small, growth, value.
I mean, Magnificent Seven and the rest of these growth stocks aren't cheap anymore. Would you agree?
I do agree with that.
And
But I'll make the point.
Yeah, of course.
That valuation has never been predictive on a 1, 3, or 5 year basis. People who want to predict where stocks are going based on valuations in the short term are routinely wrong. There's reasons why we have a cognitive disconnect in our head over valuations. and why forecasting off evaluations can't work. But said simply, if you say they can't do well because they're priced too high, well, that might be true in the long term, but not the 1, 3, or 5 year basis.
So that's just a too short time. We have this, I don't know, difference between this couple of stocks and the rest of the market, right?
Indeed.
Okay. But what would you say, what is the more realistic scenario? But you gave the answer half-wise, that the Magnificent Seven, big tech growth, can be back down to their long-term average valuation, or the rest comes up, is the more realistic scenario?
What I said was, and let me repeat and clarify, in 2024, we should see a world where all four of the categories, big, small, growth, and value, do well. But on a relative basis, the smaller in value starts to do better. But it's not that some of that, I mean, at any point in time, some stocks are falling intuitively. But it's not that the big end growth or the Magnificent Seven will go down. It's that they'll grow up smoothly, but the spreads between growth and value, big and small, shouldn't be extreme. It should be a more harmonious bull market next year than we've seen in the last couple of years.
Okay, so now we talked about a lot of about the US market. What's about the rest of the world? Will Europe stay rather weak in the next years?
So Europe is mostly a smaller and value stock world, so it ought to be doing relatively better next year. Let me say that Europe has inherent structural problems that keep its economy from growing at the kind of rate that some emerging markets and or America grow at. Europe's got a bad regulatory system for growth. The principles-based regulatory system of Europe, as opposed to America's rules-based system, is a disadvantage because it creates ambiguity for companies. And where you've got ambiguity in rules and regulations, companies tend to be more cautious. There isn't the laddered financial structure for growth in Europe that there is in America, or the governmental commitment to fund growth that there is in China. If you look, for example, at America, you have a vibrant venture capital community, a vibrant private equity community, a vibrant public debt and private debt market. But if you take just, and I'm making an example off the top of my head, if you look at the 10 largest private equity firms in the world, 8 of them are in America and none of them are in Europe. And then finally, if you just look at hours worked per year, Europeans on average work less hours per year than the global average and less average per year, let's say, than America. The reality is less hours worked tends to translate into less output and growth. And so there's these structural problems. But Europe's stocks next year, I think, should be doing better than they have been, because Europe, not 100%, but mostly, is a more value-oriented world. And in the United States, tech is 38% of the value of the U.S. market. In Europe, it's 11%. In some European countries, it's 0%. The fact is, when tech does well, that helps America. When tech does badly, that hurts America, and vice versa for Europe. And so in this environment, the structural features there are longer term problematic for Europe. If Europe wanted to be richer and close the wealth gap between it and America, it would focus on doing that, which would, said simply, reverse a lot of the things that I just mentioned. If you want to see the poster child for turning an economy around in Europe, it's Ireland, where they went from a low-growth, poor agricultural economy 30 years ago to what's now, of any major country, the highest income per capita and a good growth rate.
And what's about Japan? It's like everybody's darling at the moment. Everyone loves investing in Japan. Do you agree with that?
Yes and no. Japan is also more of a value market, and it should benefit from that next year. But whatever's popular is a problem. And the fact that it's popular is by itself a problem. You'd really rather have the things that have the right qualities to do well but are not popular. And that would speak more toward Europe.
And then there is, of course, this one big thing, we call it China. Do you think there is a bigger comeback next year?
So China will certainly try, and it may have a 2024 bounce back. Let me step back. If you take the American market and the European market, stock markets, they correlate pretty highly. The correlation coefficient of U.S. stocks to European stocks is high no matter what period you take. Up, down, longer term, shorter term, the last 5 years, the last 40 years. China does not correlate tightly with the global stock market. I will say, and few people say this, China is today in unrecognized secular descent. Its heyday is over. It is falling apart. It's falling apart for many reasons. I'm not suggesting it will go away, but what's happening to it is different, but is similar to what happened to Japan starting in 1990. It's got a world where she has pulled in liberty and restricted it, increased regulation and strangled the businesses that existed, that doesn't have that orientation toward innovation and growth, but is more of a copycat world, and has a significant problem with aged population. And as I mentioned earlier, in mentioning President Xi, he has carved out and largely eliminated in brutal format anybody that had any capability in their brain to be a challenge to him to create his own supremacy. He's got that supremacy, but he's squelching their economy. And so they've also overlevered themselves. And China has so many more problems than I think most people believe to be able to continue the kind of growth. Now, mind you, if you step back and look at this year's final growth forecast for China, they're just a hair whisker below the actual growth that was achieved in 2019. And China, which started at these very high growth levels decades back, has had steadily slowing growth rates because it's gotten too big to continue to grow at those fast rates. And so while it may have a bounce back, to your point, to your question, the bounce back is in a range that's this big. It's not in a range that's that big. It's not going to bounce back to the kind of growth rates it used to have. That's not possible at its size. And with the squelching of liberty and capitalistic abilities that China has engaged in under President Xi, its ability to create unexpected upside is not as great as some people think. Now, let me make one more point. You may have figured out, anybody that's read me for any long period of time has figured out that I'm a big fan of capitalism. capitalism creates all of the stuff that's new and different and better than stuff we had before, whether it's via technology or just some crazy person close to Germany and Denmark that said, these Legos will be pretty good for kids. It's the innovation and coming up with the never yet done thing, which many times fails, but when it works, changes the world, that has been the materialistic benefactor of humanity for well over 100 years now. And that feature of capitalism and the innovation and the crazy person trying some crazy thing, Elon Musk, the richest person in the world today, is something that fundamentally I just believe as a driving force is how you create wealth. When we look at China, that's not there now. When we look at China, we're not going to see that. And let me show you that in a different way that's telling. Look at the German market 12 years ago. Look at the US market 12 years ago. Look at the Australian market 12 years from now. On and on and on. Look at the Chinese market 12 years from ago on a cap-weighted basis, and it's just now where it was 12 years ago. It's no higher. It's gone nowhere since Xi became in power. If you compare Western banks, this was a year where banks were thought to be terrible. If you look at Western banks compared to Chinese banks over 12 years, the Chinese banks have done vastly worse in the stock market. If you look at Chinese semiconductor companies compared to Western semiconductor companies, the Chinese ones have done much worse. Why? Because Xi has squelched the ability to do what was being done before in China, and China will now revert to being a mature, slow growth economy, whether they bounce back or not.
So from when we look on the stock market, you see more risks than chances for the Chinese market.
Stocks are volatile. Stocks are always volatile, and volatility cuts both ways, up and down. People say it's volatile when the market falls, but when the market has a big run-up, that's volatile too. And the fact of the matter is, I will not say that China can't have a bounce in the stock market next year. It can. It may. But its long-term secular features work against it. And the economy is caught in a tighter bandwidth of growth than most people think. It can't have the economic bounce of magnitude to make people get really excited about it.
What? Let's get back to the global stock markets. What is the least likely outcome for stocks in the next year? What would you say?
So I referenced that earlier, when I said that professional forecasters forecast 1 year out as a consensus are always wrong. And that, if you think of it like a normal population distribution, a Gaussian distribution, remembering that Gauss was German. Was Gauss German or was he Austrian? I can't remember. He was Austrian. When you think of that normal population distribution, the bulge of the bell curve, the market just does not hit. The bulge of the bell curve of professionals, forecasters, forecasts for 12 months later, the market doesn't like to do. That's what's been pre-priced. Better or worse. So what's least likely is a market that comes in someplace between up maybe 5% and 0%. Maybe 6% and negative 1%. Because that's the middle of the bell curve of professional forecasters' forecasts. There are a few forecasters with very high ones. There's a few forecasters with very low ones. But again, about 20, just under 25% of the forecasters are currently forecasting a negative return for next year. 15% are currently forecasting an above average return. Above average, I'm defining as 10% long-term historical average. And so what I would say is that the least likely outcome is one that's someplace between about 6% and negative 1%. Mm.
There are many people out in the market, they think the next couple of months bonds can outperform stocks? Do you agree with that?
I think in
the shorter term.
I think in the next couple of months, something really extreme has to be happening that nobody's observing, and I'm really overconfident about for me to have a strong couple of month view about almost anything. The fact of the matter is, I think couple of month views are all kind of people overtrade. All kind of people are much too short-term oriented. All kind of people are overconfident that what they think will happen over the short term will. And the reality, I go back to earlier, I made the point about, have you ever heard Warren Buffett make a forecast about anything predicated on what central banks would do? And the answer is never. Have you ever heard Warren Buffett make a forecast of what the stock market would do or the bond market would do over a couple of months? No. I'm going to stick to those same points. Could they? Yes, they could. Will they? I don't know. Don't have a clue.
Yeah. You're not the biggest bond fan, of course, though.
Let me just say that if you take what I said earlier, which is I don't see a reason for bonds to have a great swing next year, positive or negative. If you hold to that for the year, knowing that the short-term bonds bounce around a little, then you say to yourself, why do I want a return like that? Stocks average higher than that in the long term. If you look at rolling 10-year periods, 90-plus percent of them have higher returns with stocks than with bonds, even when bonds do pretty well. Not all, but most, overwhelmingly. The reason for bonds in a portfolio is if you can't handle the volatility of stocks, and even then, sometimes that doesn't help much, like in 2022 when stocks fell, bonds were falling too, and almost as much. So that didn't really work. And the reality is the reason to have bonds is not to get interest, because if you think in terms of total return, you can create, if you will, homemade dividends or homemade interest just by withdrawing a certain amount of your principal. You're not really problematically taxed for that. But I don't really believe that bonds do very simple things. If you think of government bonds, think of bonds. Rates go up, price falls. Rates go down, price goes up. It's a mechanical thing. You could, if this, then that. If this, then that. You look at corporates, you throw in corporate risk on top. But there's no innovation. Capitalism is reflected in aggregate in stock prices over time, which includes all that innovation that I referenced earlier, captures it, and the value of it to humanity. The reason stocks have done better consists, not all the time, but overwhelmingly and most all of the time, than bonds, is because of that innovation in capitalism that gets incorporated into the wealth that's translated into the price of equities eventually. And that's true whether it's smartphones, that's true whether it's the cloud, that's true whether it's Legos, that's true whether it's any of the many innovations that arrive in capitalism. It's the never yet done things that provide all the value.
So let's move back to stocks. Which sectors and companies do you focusing on in the next year? That's of course the question that everyone on here.
And it's, I think, the hardest question you've asked me today.
Of course.
the reason it's the hardest question is you made point earlier that I had been very successful since the bottom of the market in October with the bounce effect. Sometimes you can tell what'll work. Bear market, what falls the most as categories, bounce the most early in the next bull. It's not that hard to do if you get that that's how markets work. But I mentioned also earlier that I consider 2024 to be a year where big, small, growth, and value tend to have much more harmonious and similar returns in a bull market. And that means you have to pay attention to more things, and getting more things right is harder. So what I would say is that this is a year where it becomes more of a relative stock picker's year, less of an industry picker's year. We're seeing which of the stocks within categories and industries will do better or worse is more important to return at the end of the year than seeing which industries or categories do better or worse. And that's all harder to do. And so I don't have a lot of confidence that I'm right in any of my views about stocks or industries at this point in time specifically. I don't feel like pounding the table on, I mean, you got to own stocks, so you pick stocks. But I have lesser confidence in these are the ones that are going to beat the market in 2024 than I had at the beginning of 2023 that growth and big would do well because growth and big had done worst in the bear market.
But from your point of view, what are the important key factors are for you to find attractive stocks?
So let me backpedal from that for a second and say it depends what you're looking for at a moment in time. Let's say you're looking for growth stocks, or let's say you're looking for value stocks. You're looking for two different things. If you're looking for growth stocks, the key is A and B. What's the company's gross operating profit margin? Because you can't fund great growth internally if you don't have a great gross operating profit margin, cost minus cost of goods sold. So the first, the A, is does it have a great cost of goods sold? And when I say great, what I mean is cost of goods sold, that's over 45%. Excuse me, I said that exactly backwards. A gross profit margin that's over 45%, a cost of goods sold that's under 55%. But many of the great growth companies have profit gross margins of 55, 60, 65%. That's A. B, can and does the company translate that into growth? You'll see some companies that masquerade themselves as growth companies. They have good growth margins, but the sales never seem to go up much. They've got some exotic product. It sounds really great, but somehow something's missing and they're not getting the revenue. So one part is, have they had a good gross margin in recent years, and has the good gross margin translated into good growth? And then finally, is the future plans of the business consistent with what they've been doing? On the value side, it's different than that. In the value side, it's really about their market share more than anything else. In value, you assume lower gross profit margins. In value, the companies aren't as inherently profitable. They have lower valuations relative to earnings. That's what makes them value stocks. But they don't have super fat gross margins. And they can't use those super fat gross margins to fund growth. That's also why they're value stocks. But who dominates within value? The companies that dominate their industries with high relative market share to their smaller competitors. And so in value, what you really want as value starts to emerge are the companies that within value sectors are the dominant market share players. They've got the biggest market share. That's what you're typically looking for.
There's a lot of work to do next year, I think.
So let me, I've mentioned Warren Buffett twice before. Let me offer a third Warren Buffett phrase that's important for people to keep in mind. Analyzing management is important, but it's also important to recognize that a great business model or a lousy business model is hard to overcome for any management. And I'm paraphrasing Warren Buffett's line. I may not be saying it perfectly, but it was more or less to the point that when a great management encounter takes over a lousy business model, or a lousy management takes over a great business model, it'll be the reputation of the management that changes, not the reputation of the business. And this, I believe, in 2024 is a year where you want to focus more on those. What's the model of the business? Not so much on how great is the management.
Yeah, again, a lot of work to do. But there's one asset class we didn't talk about. We have seen this week a new all-time high for gold.
Indeed.
Is gold something investors need in their portfolios?
You know, I should have thought about the fact that you'd asked that question, because Germans in particular, and Germanic-speaking countries in particular.
All gold fans here, yeah.
Always had a fan.
I'm personally not, but a lot of our viewers.
So let me make a couple simple points. When I was young, I tried to invest in gold, and my timing was terrible. I was so bad, so wrong, so consistently, that I made a solemn vow in the name of good luck to never have a forecast about gold again ever. And so I have. Let me make the next point. One of the things that I know about gold, and I've written about this quite a lot, is that gold has an okay long-term return, but it gets all of it out of a tiny percentage of its time. That is, stocks rise about two-thirds of the time. Gold loses price 85% of history and makes up for it in 15% of history. What most people do is they buy gold when it's up, and then when you've got years after that where it underperforms, they get out close to the bottom. It's, if you can time gold, you don't need any advice from me at all. Now, let me, and that's of course also true of silver and what have you. But let me make a further point on gold. Some people, not so much Germans, but some people believe that you should hold gold as a hedge against, let's say, stocks.
Yeah. Or inflation.
If you actually do correlations on those two, you learn the following. One, again, correlations are a great truth teller. They tell you if it's even possible that what you believe is true. And the fact is, gold has a lousy intermediate term correlation to inflation. If that were the case, gold would have gone through the roof the year before last and last, not now, as the rate of inflation is coming down. Second, those who believe that gold is a hedge on stocks, note what happened last week. The S&P 500 hit a new bull market peak. The DAX on an absolute price basis hit an all-time high. At the same time, gold did. That's not what you want in a hedge. You don't want gold to be a hedge against stocks because they correlate positively too much of the time. You follow? And people don't look at those correlations. They don't think about it. They think about gold. I mean, the positive correlation between gold and stocks doesn't make it a good hedge against stocks.
So, don't use gold. Ken, it was a pleasure. Very interesting. Thank you very, very much for this call.
Peter, thank you for having me. It's been fun. I look forward sometime to doing it again if you'll have me.
Absolutely. It would be a pleasure. See you next year here on the show.
Thank you.
All the best, Ken. Thank you very much.
And to you.
Freunde, und ich hoffe, ihr konntet einiges mitnehmen. Ich denke, Ken hat hier einige sehr interessante, spannende Einsichten gegeben über das Investieren, interessante Chancen für das nächste Jahr. Da ist sicherlich einiges dabei. Schreibt's gerne in die Kommentare. Und ansonsten vielen Dank fürs Zuschauen. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.